Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Today, we're going behind the scenes in Hollywood. We're going to actually do a show by that name from 1945. It's called Getting Difficult Shots in the Movies. That will be followed immediately by Behind the Mic and the Versatile Acting. That's 1940 for that one. So stay tuned if you're interested in Hollywood behind the scenes.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
What is always a source of interest to me is the amount of trouble and effort directors go to in order to photograph a scene that is on the screen, often for only a fraction of a minute. Whole crews of artisans will work over a background or some incidental object in the scene so that it may appear lifelike and realistic to the minutest detail. For instance, here are some notes gathered when Douglas Sirk was directing Summer Storm some time ago. Nathan, will you tell about it?
Well, there's a lot of artistic camera angles and odd photographic effects in the picture, but none caused director Sirk so much trouble as the shooting past the nose of a horse at George Sanders and Linda Darnell. It's one of those shots that when viewing the completed film, it's just taken for granted. That's all right as long as everything goes smoothly, but just let anything go wrong and watch out. Well, the first time the close-up was made, Sirk didn't like it because the horse's head looked artificial. Then he realized it was because the horse's whiskers were white and wouldn't photograph no matter how he arranged the lights. Finally, in desperation, Sirk called the makeup man and had him put mascara on the horse's whiskers. They photographed perfectly and took the bare artificial effect away from the horse's nose. And Hollywood defies space and time, too, in making movies. For instance, you see George and Linda walk from the interior of a woodcutter's cabin out into the woods. But it wasn't that easy in the making. The scene was actually shot backwards. On location in Lower California, a scene was shot showing the couple leaving a cabin and entering the woods. But because the cabin was real and too small to accommodate a huge camera with crew and the necessary lights, it was 3 weeks later, back on United Artists sound stages, that the start of the scene was filmed showing them leaving the interior of the cabin. It took 3 weeks and several hundred miles of travel to take the two stars through a simple doorway. That's one of the reasons movie-making is so costly.
And then there was the time the beautiful corpse was cold in death, but the weather on the United Artists soundstage was hot. Beautiful Linda Darnell lay in a silken bed for hours under the hot lights of the summer storm set, still as death. After several rehearsals of the scene were made and director Douglas Sirk was satisfied with the action, he called for the cameras to turn. But they had barely started turning when Sirk yelled, "Cut!" "Linda, you spoiled that take," said Sirk. "But it wasn't your fault. You'd better fix your makeup. There are beads of perspiration on your brow, and I've never heard of a corpse suffering from the heat."
All this adds up to one thing, one of the things that, in my opinion, has contributed so much to the fact that American motion pictures surpass the rest of the world. It is that insistence of nearly everyone on the lot to see that each and every detail is carefully considered. Everything from securing authentic scenes of pheasant hunting, even if they have to go to Mexico to get them, to the proper lighting of a horse's whisker.
And now, a word from your local announcer.
And here now are a few production briefs from behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Pretty 19-year-old Gracie Hannaford, daughter of Poodles Hannaford, the famous circus performer, made her screen debut in Warner Brothers' San Antonio, co-starring Errol Flynn and Alexis Smith. A triple talent scoop in connection with the scheduled screen version of the celebrated novel by Ayn Rand, The Fountainhead, is announced by Jack L. Warner. This production will star Humphrey Bogart and Barbara Stanwyck, and is to be directed by Mervyn LeRoy. Current plans call for early shooting because the film must be in the bag before next August, when LeRoy is committed to direct The Robe for Frank Ross. Rusty Farrell, former Powers model and Broadway dancing beauty, has been cast in RKO Radio's Those Endearing Young Charms. Robert Young and Lorraine Day are co-starred in this screen adaptation of the Edward Chodorov play.
Although she's too young to read scripts, 8-year-old Margaret O'Brien has appeared many times on national network radio programs. In all instances, she memorizes her lines and cues. Her recitation of Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in this manner remains a radio classic. And Ruth Hussey has been borrowed by RKO Radio from MGM to co-star with Pat O'Brien in Man Alive. They teamed before in Marine Raiders. Adolphe Manjou has a top role in this comedy, dealing with a man, supposedly dead, who comes to spy on his wife's efforts to commune with the spirits.
Shelby Payne, who makes her film debut in This Love of Ours, has joined the growing list of actress writers with a volume of poems to be published soon. Marking the completion of his 40th year in show business, more than 30 of which have been in motion pictures, Wallace Beery recently signed a new contract with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios and began preparation for his next film, Bad Bascom. It's the story of a colorful bandit leader in the 1860s who is reformed through his affection for a little girl. Raymond Massey, in real life a veteran of both World War I and II, has worn a uniform in only 5 of the 152 stage and screen roles in which he has played. Philip Terry gets the romantic lead in George White's Scandals of 1945, the musical co-starring Joan Davis and Jack Haley. This will be Terry's third straight appearance in a musical. Music in Manhattan, his first, will be followed by Pan Americana, in which he's one of the principals. Terry will play opposite Martha Holliday in George White's Scandals of 1945. Gene Krupa has already been set for a featured part.
At least one soldier believes Gary Cooper doesn't know when he's well off being sick. The story goes like this. Cooper and Ingrid Bergman were playing their 18th love scene in Saratoga Trunk when the soldier visited the Warner Brothers set. As do many of the romantic sessions of the Edna Ferber story, the scene began with a battle. Climax of the scene came when the sizzling, angry Ingrid softened and was swiftly gathered into the Cooper arms and soundly kissed, only to hear him say, "You know something, honey? You make me sick." In the silence immediately after Director Sam Wood had ordered cut, the soldier visitor gasped but loudly, "I'd be glad to be awful sick for that kind of medicine."
And who wouldn't? Over at RKO Radio, Boris Karloff has been signed to a new contract calling for him to make 3 pictures within the next 2 years. He starred in this studio's The Body Snatcher, drama adapted from Robert Louis Stevenson's story of the same name. With Robert Montgomery set to portray the leading role in They Were Expendable, director John Ford is now making extensive tests of players to complete the cast. Production is scheduled to begin before the end of the month. Floria Hope, young MGM actress, is forsaking a really promising screen career to marry her childhood sweetheart, Captain Jack Lewis of Fort Monmouth, New Jersey. She asked for and received a release from her contract to do it. She has a top role in MGM's forthcoming Twice Blessed.
And here's a case of really turning tables. Anne Blythe, a young actress who portrays one of Joan Crawford's daughters in Warner Brothers' Mildred Pierce, has turned the tables on autograph collectors who visit the set where the picture is shooting. Whenever Anne spots a particularly beribboned military or naval uniform on the set, she steps up and requests an autograph from the decorated veteran.
This program is for your entertainment, and we would be very glad to hear from you requesting more of that portion of the program which pleases you most. Just drop a card to me, Bidwell McCormick, Post Office Box 2941 Hollywood, or to the station over which you are now listening, and state whether you wish more facts about motion pictures, Hollywood studios, or what the stars are doing, and we will try and bring this information to you.
And now a word from your local announcer.
Because there seems to be so much that should be said about the man chosen for the personality close-up in today's issue of Behind the Scenes in Hollywood, we are breaking our usual practice and presenting the story of only one person, Walt Disney. Okay.
Arriving in Hollywood 2 decades ago with only $40 in the pockets of his well-worn suit, Walt Disney has mixed equal proportions of persistence, imagination, and hard work to parlay a series of animated characters into a corporation that today occupies a $2 million studio. Walter Elias Disney was born in Chicago on December 5, 1901. Disney Sr. was a contractor and builder in the Windy City and later moved to a Missouri farm. Walt picked up the rudiments of his education in a country school. that Disney soon tired of rural life, and Walt completed his grammar school grades in Kansas City. After classes, he ran with the track team, his only excursion into athletics. The family moved back to Chicago, and young Walt enrolled in McKinley High. Just about this time, the ambitious youth began to sketch and became interested in photography. And while doing illustrations for the high school paper, he also started experimenting with motion pictures, the two mediums he later was to combine to give the world a new art form. Meanwhile, Disney attended night classes at the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts to improve his sketching technique. The First World War was underway, and he tried to enlist in the Army, but was turned down because of his age. Finally, he was successful in signing up as a Red Cross ambulance driver and went to France. Covered from stem to stern with Walt's drawings, the Disney-driven vehicle was probably the most unusual conveyance of its kind along the battlefront. Then came the armistice, and an animated slide company needed a cartoonist, and Walt landed the job at Kansas City. He rigged up a studio of his own in a garage, and in his spare time began experimenting. His first output was a short reel of Kansas City happenings, which he sold to the owner of three theaters. They were so popular with audiences that he was commissioned to turn out one such an animated picture every week. From boyhood, Walt Disney loved mice and kept several as pets. One of them used to crawl over his drawing board back in those Kansas City garage days. Walt named the pet Mortimer Mouse, but that sounded too formal, and before long the moniker was changed to Mickey. This was the model for the character who subsequently became a screen star. While experimenting in the garage workshop, Walt retained his $35 a week job so he could eat. But nights in his studio, a volunteer staff of cartoonists enthusiastic about the idea worked 6 months to complete that short subject, Little Red Riding Hood. Disney liked the finished result so well he quit his job and formed a company to make more of these animated fairy tales. Things began to look rosy when 7 were completed and sold to a New York distributor. Then the New York outfit went broke, and Disney's enterprise suffered the same fate. So, using his old motion picture camera, Walt took photographs of babies around Kansas City, selling the prints to adoring parents and getting enough money together to move to Hollywood. He landed in the film capital with a new sweater, but a suit that was 2 years old and only $40 in his pockets. Besides that, he had a little film and some drawing material. Walt's brother Roy was already in Hollywood. Roy offered Walt his sympathy and a $250 bank balance. As a result, they formed a partnership, with an uncle staking the brothers to $500 more. Walt was overjoyed when a print of a fairy tale sent to New York brought an order for a series like the sample. The brothers rented an old real estate office, bought a camera, and Walt taught Roy how to use it. They hired 2 girls to help them. Walt did all the drawing. The quartet then began turning out an Alice series, and then Walt fell in love with one of the girls. Lillian Bounds was her name, and they were married. They're still married and have 2 children, one of them adopted. Soon the Alice series had been exploited to its fullest, and Disney conceived another character, Oswald the Rabbit. The public took to the new animated star, and Disney, bubbling with ideas, went to New York in an effort to get more money for the film so he could experiment with technique improvements. The distributors refused, and there was a break, the New York outfit keeping Oswald. His high hopes were shattered. Jobless, Walt and Mrs. Disney started back to Hollywood, and on the way they discussed their future. In search of a new character, he considered several animals without success, and then he excitedly exclaimed, "A mouse! My Mickey Mouse! Why didn't I think of it before?" His third Mickey Mouse picture, Steamboat Willie, was synchronized with sound. Critics, film executives, and paying audiences were wildly enthusiastic about the picture. Mickey went on and on until he became a household word. Then came the Silly Symphonies, plotless artistic creations that were pure fantasy in color. Since 1932, they've won Academy Awards year after year. Restless and never satisfied with his own work, Disney was not content with the turn in fortune that brought him prestige and a great deal of money. He dreamed of a full-length animated feature in color. It was a terrific gamble, as no one could foresee public reaction to a feature picture composed entirely of drawings. Dipping into his own financial resources and then borrowing $1,500,000, Walt produced Snow White and the 7 Dwarfs. This Disney gamble is one of Hollywood's favorite success stories. 3 months after its release, Snow White had paid back the loan and then went on to become one of the greatest moneymakers in all screen history.
Disney was now firmly established in the feature field. He then produced a number of full-length films appealing to adults and children alike, including Pinocchio, Bambi, and Dumbo. Walt again made screen history by putting Leopold Stokowski and a symphony orchestra under contract to bring some of the world's greatest music to the screen in Fantasia. Now, in The Three Caballeros, Disney scores another technical triumph by merging animated characters and real-life actors in the same film scenes.
And this is the word picture of a young man with an idea, a chap who has endeared little guys like Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck to the whole world, who has made lovely legend walk and talk and glorified color on the screen.
Listen next week when Bidwell McCormick again takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But radio isn't all on the surface. There are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you. The human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name since the beginning of broadcasting has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gil Martin. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. Behind the Mic presents one of the most versatile character actors in radio. When a radio director is casting a show and he wants a man who can play a Scotchman in one part of the show and a pack of wolves in another, he probably hires our next guest. You might have heard him as the villain on the Dick Tracy program one night and as a funny voice on the Fred Allen show another. As a matter of fact, he plays so many parts that I suggest you be mighty careful about swatting a moth in your closet. It just might be Charlie Cantor. Charlie, exactly what kind of dialects do you do?
Well, Monsieur McNamee, I can do a French dialect like this if you prefer. I can also play the part of a blooming cockney from East 10 with pearl buttons. And if you don't like that, well, doggone, bless my ass britches from Memphis, I can stand here with my bare feet hanging out and talk like this here.
But I can talk a little like I've just been kissing the Blarney Stone.
Maybe you like a little Italian by then, eh, like this? Then I can play the Scotchman, like the Scotchman who went to the dentist and asked how much to pull my tooth. And the dentist says $2, and the Scotchman said, okay, here's a buck, just loosen it.
And Charlie, I suppose you speak English, too.
My friend, you're asking, so I'm telling. You can take everything away, but don't take away my Yankee accent.
You not only do dialects, but you also play those two popular little characters on the Fred Allen show.
You mean the dopey man who talks something like this, yeah.
And the little man who talks way up here like this, yeah.
Yes, I do, Graham.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Charlie, we had a man on this program who impersonates animals.
Yeah, what does he do with animals?
Impersonates animals, Charlie. Do you also impersonate animals?
Well, yes, Graham, for comedy purposes. For instance, on one program, I was called upon to do a lovesick chicken, which sounded something like this. And once I was called upon to do a parrot, which sounded something like this.
Hello, buddy bully, buddy bully. Hello.
Another week, I was called upon to do a hen laying an egg, and it sounded something like this.
Oh. I wonder how a program sounds when it lays an egg, Tom.
Well, I hope I never find out.
Besides playing dialects and characters on shows, what other unusual things do radio directors call upon you to do?
Well, lots of things, Graham. For instance, I'm generally called upon to do funny laughs. One show, I had to do the laugh of a man who was looking over the shoulder of another man who was reading the funnies in the subway, and as the paper doesn't belong to him, it was a sort of a repressed laugh, like this. Then there's the timid laugh that I have to do at times like this. And then, still another comedy show, I had to do a laugh like a man who was waiting outside of the delivery room in a hospital. His wife is expecting a baby. The nurse comes out and tells him it's a boy. Also a girl. Another boy.
Oh. Folks, when I said he was versatile, I wasn't kidding. Charlie? Just out of curiosity, did you have any theatrical experience before you got into radio?
Well, Graham, I've been in radio 11 years, but I did play in vaudeville for quite some time. When I was in school...
High school?
Well, I won't say it was college, but my brother was a vaudevillian, and he had a comedy act. During the summer, he used to fire his straight man, and I'd substitute for his straight man for 8 weeks, and in that way, make my school tuition expenses for the whole year. And do you know who the first straight man my brother fired to make room for me was?
No, who?
Archie Leach, who is now better known as Cary Grant, believe it or not.
So Cary Grant was fired so you could take his place.
That's right, Graham.
Well, is there any chance of RKO doing that to Cary now?
Oh, I wouldn't let him, Graham. Gosh, I wouldn't let him railroad me into that.
No.
I'd hate to play those mushy love scenes opposite Loretta Young or Myrna Loy or Hedy Lamarr.
Oh.
No, 1,000 times no.
All right, Keeper, I'll come quietly.
Thank you, Charlie Cantor. Oddities in radio. Presenting odd little true stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. Oddity number one. A few years ago, newscaster Mark Hawley was master of ceremonies on a program for a shoe account emanating from Buffalo. The commercial announcement was done by two women, Mrs. Miller and Mrs. Johnson, who talked over the back fence about things pertaining to shoes. One day, the time of the broadcast was changed. Through sheer forgetfulness, the two women who did the commercials were not notified. Hawley and his announcer didn't realize this until just before the show, and nothing could be done. When they came to the commercial, there was only one thing to do, and the announcer and Hawley did it. They slipped into falsetto and...
How are you this morning, Mrs. Miller?
Oh, I'm so glad to see you, Mr. Johnson.
Oh, yeah, how's the family?
Oh, everybody's fine except little Willie. His corns are bothering him. He's got arch trouble.
Oh, he has?
Yes.
Well, you know, George Jr. had the very same trouble, and we found the most wonderful shoes.
That's
They're simply marvelous.
They went on and on. After the broadcast was over, Hawley, worried to death, got a phone call from the sponsor.
Yes? Yes, well, I can explain.
I want to know who those two women were.
Well, they were just two women who we called in because, well, we were in an emergency and...
Well, they were terrific. Get rid of those two regular women and we'll hire them.
Oddity number two. Years ago in the early days of radio, when NBC was still at 711 Fifth Avenue instead of its present palatial quarters at Radio City, radio was not quite the almost perfect technical thing it is today. For instance, in those days, there was no emergency lighting system. And if the lights in the studio went out, the studio was dark until the lights were fixed. For a few brief seconds, we take you back to those early days of radio when there was an unwritten rule that if the lights went out when an orchestra was playing, the orchestra would perform Dixie, because that was the one number all the boys could play together without looking at their music. Well, one day, Frank Black was conducting his orchestra and the lights went out at the finish of a number. Instead of the next regularly scheduled selection, the orchestra went into... At the finish of Dixie, the studio lights were fixed and the orchestra resumed its regular program. Suddenly, the lights went out again. And that's exactly what happened. All I can say is, if that ever happened to our orchestra leader here, Ernie Watson, he'd drop dead. Oddity number three. A few weeks ago, Samuel Kaufman, radio feature writer, hailed a taxi.
Hey, cab. Take me downtown to New York Sun. Know where it is?
I know all the ways to get there.
Oh, you do, eh? Well, take me the short way.
Say, buddy, you got a radio back there. What do you say you turn it on?
No, thanks. I don't want to hear the radio.
Well, maybe you don't, but I do.
Oh, I see. Well, where do you want me to turn it?
You turn the dial, I'll tell you. Yeah, that's right, right there. Now turn on the juice.
Just a moment. Pop my curiosity. But who do you want to listen to?
A guy I never miss. Uncle Don.
And for those of you who don't know Uncle Don, Uncle Don conducts a well-known kiddie program. Thank you, Sam Kaufman. You played the part of yourself to perfection. Your radio favorite's favorite food. In the upper reaches of New York's theatrical district, where actors are legion, Schubert is king, and Damon Runyon and Walter Winchell are court chroniclers, there is a restaurant which has become as much of a habit with some of your favorite radio stars as worrying about their Crosley ratings. And for no particular reason, we thought you listeners might be interested in some of the food habits of your radio favorites and what they eat. So we have brought you the man who can best give you this information, the proprietor of Lindy's, New York's famous restaurant, Leo Linderman, or Lindy himself. Lindy, suppose you start telling us about the food habits of the famous radio personalities who put on the feed bag in your restaurant.
Who would you like to hear about, Graham? Oscar Levant?
Yes. What is Oscar Levant's favorite food?
Well, Graham, I think it must be coffee, because when he comes into my restaurant, he will drink at least 10 cups.
That's probably what keeps him so wide awake on information, please.
Then do you know what he likes to do? He likes to steal cookies and macaroons out of the cake box.
Naughty, naughty Oscar. One more swiped cookie and Papa will take away your encyclopedia, Britannica. I can't say encyclopedia Britannica. Did you know, sir? Well, how about some other favorites? Say, Eddie Cantor.
Well, Eddie is crazy about well-done hamburgers. He generally starts his dinner with a little dry sherry, and then he's very fond of bologna and eggs.
Well, when he comes into your restaurant, does he eat by himself?
Oh, no. Eddie is crazy about company. He generally comes in with his wife, Ida, and a party of 10 or 12 people. How would you like to hear about Jack Benny?
Yes, I would. Because if eating has anything to do with the salary Jack makes, I'm going to change my diet.
Then you better start eating lots of fish. Jack's favorite seems to be sturgeon and Nova Scotia salmon sandwiches. And for dessert, he has...
Yes, I know that product he advertises.
Boynton and Allen also like all kinds of fish.
Well, how about a real gourmet, like Paul Whiteman?
He's not a gourmet anymore. He used to love rich foods.
You mean the days when he was known as two sleepy people?
Yes, but that was before he went on his diet. Now when he does come in, which is very seldom, he eats things like boiled steak, a lamb chop, gluten bread, and for dessert, stewed food without sugar.
So that's how Paul keeps his schoolgirl figure, eh?
Yes, Walter Winchell has a pretty heavy appetite for a thin man. Because of his work, he generally eats dinner about 2 o'clock in the morning. He always asks if there's anything left over from dinner, and he will have that. He likes all egg dishes and fish, and like Eddie Cantor, he's a bologna and egg feed. He's also very fond of conversation of marinated herring.
Lindy, I think we have just about time for one more celebrity diet.
What about J. Edgar Hoover? He makes radio speeches once in a while.
Well, that's kind of stretching a point. But just out of curiosity, what is J. Edgar Hoover's favorite fodder?
He likes raw meat and lots of it.
Uh-oh. Well, the next time I pass him, if I find myself without an arm, I'll know what happened. But thank you, Lindy. Thank you very much for the fodder falderals. behind how a cab driver became a successful radio and Broadway show writer. Recently, a new musical comedy hit came into Broadway to the applause of the critics. The show was Hold On to Your Hats, and it starred Al Jolson. One of those responsible for the funny book of the show is a fellow named Eddie Davis, who for the last few years has been very successful as a radio writer. But before Eddie Davis got into radio, oh, but here he is, and we'll let Eddie tell it himself. Eddie Davis. Eddie, before we go into the start of your career, will you please tell the audience who are some of the radio comedians for whom you've written?
Well, for 6 years, I was one of Eddie Cantor's writers. He gave me my start in radio. Then I also written for Al Jolson, Ed Wynn, Jack Haley, Joe Penn, and Milton Berle, and many others.
Mm-hmm. What did you do before you started writing for radio?
Graham, I used to drive a cab. And believe it or not, that cab actually helped me to get my first radio job.
How was that, Eddie?
Well, it was about 8 years ago. You see, between 8 and 9 in the evenings, I used to park my cab in front of the New Amsterdam Theater. In those days, Eddie Cantor was doing his broadcast there. I used to listen to the Cantor program and write down the jokes I thought he should have used on the show. Then right after the show, I'd go upstairs and see Eddie and tell him those jokes. Most of them were pretty punk. He wouldn't use them, but I kept right on trying. After giving him the jokes, I'd wait downstairs and drive him home. One night, I parked my cab in front of the New Amsterdam Theater, listened to Eddie Cantor's broadcast, and I hurried upstairs to the studio and I...
Wait a minute, buddy. The only people who can get through this corridor are the actors on the show.
Listen, you're new around here, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
Then you don't know me. I'm Mr. Cantor's chauffeur. I just want to tell him where his car is parked.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Cantor.
So I says to the guy, how do you like that guy? Oh, hello, Davis. Say, look, you mind telling me just one thing? How were you able to pass the man at the door to get in here?
Just personality, Mr. Cantor. Plain place. But nevertheless, I got a joke I wanted you to do tonight.
Yeah?
Look, you could open up the program by saying, Jimmy, what do you think? This morning I opened up my closet and find a little Mort crying. And Jimmy says, wait a minute, who ever heard of a Mort crying? And you could say, well, didn't you ever hear of a Mort ball?
Well, maybe I could use something like that.
Look, I got another one you could have used. You could use it next week. You open the program, you say, Jimmy, what does NBC stand for? And Wallington says, National Broadcasting Company. And you say, how do you like that? And all the time I thought it was nothing but Cantor.
Well, that's not bad. Look, just on the chance I might be able to use it, Eddie, here's a little something for yourself.
Can you imagine? I saw the guy to Cantor. Me, Eddie Davis, a cab driver. I'm selling jokes to Cantor. I gotta go before I faint.
Look, where are you going?
I gotta phone my wife. Helen, do you hear that? Tell the baby, Evelyn. I saw the gag to Cantor. How do you like that?
Wait a second. Maybe you can sell some more jokes to Cantor. I'm doing a routine on daylight saving time next week. I want some jokes on watches. You think you could write a couple?
A couple? I'll write 100. I'll write 1,000,000. Say, give me a nickel. I wanna phone my wife. I saw the cab. I'm so excited. I don't know what I'm saying, really.
Wait, you haven't written them yet. Going to be waiting for me downstairs and drive me home?
Am I? You're going to be driven like you never was driven before.
All right, Eddie, take me home.
Okay, Mr. Cantor. Say, I've been thinking about those gags. You know, you told me to write for next week. You know, the ones about the watches.
Look, Eddie, I'm a nervous man. I've got a wife and 5 children. Just as a favor to Cantor, please don't turn around when you talk.
All right. But look, about those watch gags. Suppose you were to come on a stage with a watch hanging out in the back of your pocket, and Wellington was to say, Eddie, what have you got that watch hanging out in the back pocket for? And you say, I can't help it. I'm behind times, Jimmy. You like that?
Hey, look out for that truck!
Hey, why don't you look where you're going, you big baloney?
I'll flatten you.
Yeah? You and who else? I've got Cantor in my cab. I'll have him take a poke at it. Go ahead, Cantor. Show him how you fight. Go ahead.
Davis, listen, I'm a comedian, not a prize fighter.
That's the trouble with the cab business these days. These truck drivers think they own the street. Say, I got another watch gag. You could bring out a watch and show it to Wellington and say you call it your Woolworth watch because it's always 5 to 10. You like that? 5 to 10. Just scrape his fender a little bit, and he puts up a big yell. How do you like a guy
like
that?
Listen, Davis, as a personal favor to my wife, my 5 children, and my sponsor, will you please keep your eyes on the road?
I'm keeping my eyes on the road. Say, how about this one? Joe Wellington another watch, and he says, Eddie, there's something missing on that watch. And you say, yes, I know. Things are so bad, I laid off one of the hands.
Well, kid, there's one thing about you. You always keep on punching.
I thought of another one. Listen to this one.
Hey, look out! Say, Davis, as a matter of self-protection, next week I want you to work for me at a salary as a writer.
I'd rather hire you than be killed by you.
Thank you, Eddie Davis. Thank you. That was a strange beginning of a fine career. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. Tonight's questions will be answered by Al Newman, radio editor of the magazine Newsweek. Mr. Philip M. Lewis of Salt Lake City writes in to ask, how does a sponsor tell whether his program is popular or not?
Well, Mr. Lewis, there are certain organizations that specialize in finding out the comparative popularity of programs. This is mostly done by taking a cross-section of various areas in the country and finding out by telephone what programs people are listening to at the moment and what programs they've listened to during the day. The sponsor can sometimes tell about the popularity of his program by the increase of the sale of his product since the program went on the air.
Miss Beulah Allison of New York City asks this. What is meant by the expression soap opera?
Soap opera, or soap saga, as it's sometimes called, is slang for a daytime radio serial. They're so called because so many of these serials are sponsored by large soap concerns.
Mr. William White of Saranac Lake, New York, writes in to ask, I have often heard the word stooge used as pertaining to a radio character. Will you please tell me exactly what a stooge is and how did the word originate?
Well, to take the last part of Mr. White's question first, there have been a great many explanations of the origin of stooge, but one of the most logical seems to be this. In the days when vaudeville was really vaudeville, and when an actor needed someone to say a few lines in his act, he'd sometimes hire an amateur to teach him how to deliver the lines, and maybe even how to sing a song. Such a person was called a student. Either through mispronunciation or carelessness, the word became stoogent, and was eventually shortened to stooge. Through the course of years, the term stooge became applied to a professional actor who played a subsidiary part in a vaudeville act. On the air, the term stooge is generally applied to a minor comedy character. Some famous stooges of radio have been Parky Carcass, Schlepperman of the Jack Benny program, Beadle of the Phil Baker program, and Tizzy Lish on the Al Pierce show.
Thank you, Al Newman. Thank you for answering those questions. Radio broadcast helped save the life of a great football star. This past July, Ken Strong, former All-American football player and star of the New York football Giants, one of the greatest backs the game has ever produced, was deathly ill. But we'll let Ken tell it himself. Come on. He'll tell you about it. Ken Strong. Ken, exactly what was the matter with you?
Well, Graham, I had a bad case of stomach ulcers, and they had burst. I was operated on at the Flushing Hospital at 1 o'clock in the morning. The next night, I took a turn for the worse. I felt terrible. Not only physically ill, but mentally down. Not long before, my boy had had a ruptured appendix, and that and my own illness weighed upon me. There were two people I kept asking for, my two closest friends, Stan Lomax, a sports writer and commentator, and Tim Mara, the owner of the Giants. About 3 o'clock in the morning, the doctor phoned Stan, and he said,
Hello, Mr. Lomax. Well, Ken is terribly sick. Now, what worries me most, though, is his mental condition. It just doesn't seem as if he cares to get well. And he's got to if he's going to pull through. He needs something to shock him into one to fight and live. Isn't there something you can do? I think you can.
Stan was a real friend, Graham. The next evening, when he went on the air for his regular sports broadcast, this is what he said.
Good evening, everyone. The greatest football player New York has ever produced, Ken Strong, is seriously ill at the Flushing Hospital. You've cheered him on the football field. Here's your chance to encourage him in something far more important, his fight for life. Write him and let him know that you're all pulling for him to win this biggest fight of all. Hello, Flushing Hospital. This is Herman Bagassi of Staten Island. Will you tell Ken Strong he's just got to get better and...
Say, operator, I'm a cop. And Strong don't know me, but you tell him that all the boys on the force are pulling for him to come through. And be sure and tell him that...
Say, what'll I do with these wires, miss? They're all for Ken Strong.
I'll have them brought up to his room. Oh, look at all these letters, Mr. Strong. Thousands of them from people who want you to get better.
Well, Graham, when I found how people were pulling for me, I felt if I didn't get better, I'd be letting them and my family, my friends, and everybody down. And I knew this was one touchdown I had to make.
You not only made it, Ken, but you knocked the Grim Reaper for a goal. And you're still with the New York Giants, of course.
Yes, I am, Graham. And if any of those people that wrote or phoned the hospital are listening, I'd like to personally thank them from the bottom of my heart.
Well, thank you. And the very best of luck to you, Ken Strong, and also to your New York Giants.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, write a letter to us. Address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. As many questions as possible will be answered by mail, and the three or four questions we feel to be of most general interest will be answered on this program. Be sure to listen next week when we will bring you the inside story of football broadcasts, as told by Bill Stern and Swede Larson, coach of the Navy. What happened when a Zulu made his appearance on the radio broadcast? How radio brought help in the life and death crisis down in the Pacific Ocean? And more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy, and the drama that are found behind the mic. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
If you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, be sure and write a letter to us and address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. Now, all the questions, and as many as possible, will be answered by mail. And the three or four questions we feel to be of the most general interest will be answered on this program. Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music is composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
Eddie Cantor went to San Francisco and visited with the mayor, 1947.
Welcome back, Eddie. Welcome back. Welcome back from seeing the preview of your new picture, If You Knew Susie, up in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Say, Eddie, tell me, did you have a good time up there?
Did I have a good time here?
Yeah.
Of course, Harry. San Francisco is a wonderful town, and so cosmopolitan. Why, Harry, from where I stayed, San Francisco was just like a breath of old New York.
Where did you stay, at the top of the mark?
No, at the bottom of Fisherman's Wharf.
Well, Eddie, I heard that when you arrived at San Francisco, you were welcomed at the station by the governor. Were you thrilled at meeting him?
I'll say I was, Harry. To think that Governor Warren would take time out to come down to the station just to meet me.
Yeah.
A broken-down actor that happens to be a radio star and a big motion picture celebrity. To think he came to meet me. What a man.
The governor?
No, me. What picture has the governor ever been in, Harry?
Now, Eddie, wait a minute. Aren't you being just a little hammy?
No, after all. Can the governor roll his eyes, clap his hands, and sing, If You Knew Susie?
No.
Can he do that? No.
No.
Can the governor go on the radio and tell jokes? No. Has the governor got 5 children? No. He's got 6. No. When the governor hands you a cigar, you don't know whether it's for a boy, a girl, or a vote. It's true, Harry.
Well, Eddie, I bet you felt very important being with the governor.
I sure did. He invited me to stay at his house, and he treated me like a big shot.
He did.
Oh, we stayed up till 5 in the morning, talking about living conditions, high finance, and we had different views on the subject, of course.
You did?
Yeah, he wanted $5 for my room, and I only wanted to pay him 2.5.
Well, what did you finally arrive at?
A motel in Oakland. Let me tell you something, Harry. But really, I was emotionally touched when the governor asked me to be guest of honor at his banquet. And when I sat next to him at the head of the table, I was moved.
You were?
Down to the foot of the table, I'll tell you. And after dinner, Harry, the governor said, Mr. Cantor, the guests and I wanted to ask you if you wouldn't sing a song.
Oh, and you sang a song?
No, they asked me if I wouldn't sing a song. Harry, I was so delighted to be there, I did cartwheels all over the room.
Well, what did that get you?
A big lump on the head. And the governor's wife. Oh, the governor's wife was so wonderful.
You mean she did something for the lump on your head?
Yeah, she took a big vase and tried to hammer it down. I'm only kidding, Harry. She was swell. But speaking of wives, Harry, I'm having terrible trouble with mine.
You're having trouble with Ida?
No, my other wife.
Your other wife?
Harry, let me explain something. Oh, don't laugh. Don't laugh, Harry. In my new picture, If You Knew Susie, there was a wedding scene where I got married to Joan Davis.
Yeah.
Well, we were married by a ship's captain in the picture, and the actor who performed the ceremony was really a ship's captain.
Well, so what?
So that made it legal.
Oh, no.
Now I've got 2 wives. Isn't that big of me?
That's very big of you. I couldn't afford it.
But... No, no. Harry, how can you clown? How can you clown when I'm in such terrible trouble? I'm expecting an attorney. I just called my lawyers. Finkelhoff, 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 and Finkel.
I wonder which one is Finkel.
How do you do?
That's Fred Gordon, the mad lawyer. Russian, you are a lawyer?
I refuse to answer by advice of counsel.
Wait a minute. How can you be a lawyer? Your father was a cashier in a bank. Don't you want to follow in his footsteps?
Follow in his footsteps?
Yes.
Don't be silly. Why should I go to Alcatraz?
Well, if you're a lawyer, you've got to help me. I'm in desperate trouble. I'm stuck with 2 wives.
Give her that's nothing. Nothing.
What do you mean that's nothing?
I'm stuck with 1.
Look, Russian, do you really know anything about law?
This you wouldn't believe because it's a lie.
Yep.
You know,
yeah.
I studied law many years.
Yeah.
I have read everything printed about law.
Yeah.
In mine head is 1,000 law books. And you see these ears?
Yes.
Bookends.
Russian, I'm convinced you never even went to law school.
That is a gross misfalsification.
Yes.
And I can't prove it.
Yes.
Sir?
Yep.
I graduated from college magna cum laude.
No, louder.
Magna cum laude.
Louder, louder.
You still can't hear me.
No, you... Russian, you're no lawyer.
I'm not only a lawyer, I'm also a barrister.
Well, or what's the difference?
What's the difference?
Yeah.
What's the difference to you? It's all the same to me.
No, you fool. I can see where you won't be any help to me at all.
Don't say that. That don't say. I've solved many problems.
Yeah.
Do you know John's other wife?
Certainly I know John's other wife.
What'll you give me if I don't tell John?
No, don't. Fine. I need a great legal mind and I get you. This is serious. Don't you understand? Joan Davis is claiming me for her husband. I've already got a wife. Look, what experience have you had in the courtroom?
Oh, you crook, you. I've handled many long suits and tiresome cases.
Yep.
These I call suitcases.
Oh. These are suitcases.
Yeah. Last week I defended a midget.
A midget, yes?
That was a briefcase.
Go! What happened? What happened?
The midget was convicted and they sentenced him.
The electric chair?
No, the electric toaster.
No! Look, Russian, I'm looking for a man who can handle domestic cases.
Then look on me. Look on me.
I'm looking on you.
In lo-
do you mind if I play a little bit of a...
No. In Los Angeles, I am long remembered by the case of Schmo versus Schmo.
Yes.
I defended Schmo.
All right. Now tell me, Schmo, what was the case about?
I was not the Schmo you're thinking of.
What was the case about?
You see...
Yes?
He was suing his wife for divorce on the grounds that she was going around with another man.
Yes.
In court, by mine eloquent...
Yes?
I proved to the jury that the other man was a blackguard, a scoundrel, and a menace to society.
Oh, that's terrible, breaking up a home. I'd like to meet that other man.
How do you do?
Go ahead!
Let's wrap up this edition of Behind the Scenes in Hollywood with an episode of Imagine That, Motion Pictures from 1940.
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Bandits used barbed wire to rob a bank.
Dolly Madison was the only woman in private life to be accorded the privileges of the floor in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Can you imagine that? Once more, friends, this is Lindsay McCary bringing you another session of this series in which we try to amaze you with odd facts and unusual news stories from the past. And here's our first interesting item. It's really two in one because, well, just listen to the gentleman from Tennessee speaking on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives on Jackson Day, January 8, 1844.
Oh, Mr. Speaker, what a colossal blot of shame rests upon this great government this day. This day, Mr. Speaker, we honor that great soldier and statesman, our revered and beloved 7th President of these United States, Andrew Jackson. Mr. Speaker, while we so do him this just honor, that grand old man of 77 years rests quietly in his home in Nashville, harassed by the shameful knowledge that this government has seen fit one horrible day to levy a fine of $1,000 upon him for contempt of court, but really for the assiduous execution of his faithful duty as he saw it.
Will the gentleman from Tennessee yield?
I yield to the gentleman from North Carolina.
Mr. Speaker, I've just noticed a beloved person sitting in the gallery of this house, a woman whose memory shall ever be revered by this nation because of her heroic acts 32 years ago, in saving from the hands of an enemy one of our most precious historic documents, the Declaration of Independence. Of course, I refer to Mrs. Dolly Payne Madison, widow of our fourth president. I move you that a committee be appointed on the part of this House to wait on Mrs. Madison and to assure her that whenever it shall be her pleasure to visit the house, she be requested to take a seat within the hall.
Thus did the United States House of Representatives honor 74-year-old Dolly Madison, widow of James Madison, by according her the privileges of the floor of the House. Up to the present writing, Dolly Madison is the only woman in private life who has ever been accorded this honor. Can you imagine that? It was also during that same year, 1844, that Congress ordered Andrew Jackson's $1,000 contempt of court fine to be repaid with interest. The aged ex-president later received a U.S. government warrant to the amount of $2,700. You've often heard the expression, you can drive a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Well, from a newspaper of more than 35 years ago comes this story. Mr. Charles Cott was driving his horse and wagon down a street in Chicago on a cold, wintry mid-December day. Perhaps Mr. Cott had a little early Christmas spirit. At any rate, as he drove along...
Today's the other way we go. Oh, just look, there's good old Quigley's Saloon. I gotta stop and have a little drink. Steady, boy, steady. You know, there's nothing like a little drink on a cold December day. No, sir. Now, you wait here, boy, you wait here, and I'll be right up. Oh, no, you don't have to wait here. You're coming with me. Horses have gotta get warm inside, too. And I'll get you in the harness here. You and me will have a little drink of good old Quigley's Saloon. Now, come on. Won't old Quigley be surprised? Come on, let's go. Come on. What'd you say? What? Oh, yes, you do want a drink. Now, come on. Don't be stubborn. You can have a little drink with me. Come on now. You can have a drink, I tell you. Oh, come on.
Mr. Cott's horse did not enter Quigley's for the little drink, but Mr. Cott did enter court the next day, charged with disturbing the peace. Perhaps the judge was an animal fancier, for his sentence was...
Charles Cott, I appreciate the motives, but not the method. I'm going to let you off, though, and find you merely the court cost. But hereafter, don't try to drag your horse into a saloon.
So did Charles Cott of Chicago learn the full force of the old proverb... You can drive a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. Can you imagine that? The ultimate in bank robbery stories comes from a newspaper of January 2, 1909. It seems that in Wellston, Oklahoma, some of the townspeople were surprised to see... Ah, but listen.
Hey, what's the idea over there by the bank? Look.
Hey, what's going on? I didn't hear nothing about them building a barbed wire fence around the place. What do you suppose the idea?
I don't know. Well, that's... Hey! Look, them fellas building the fence have got guns.
Well, yeah. Well, some of them are scattering along the fence. That's a holdup.
Darned if it ain't. Them fellas built that fence to hold us off while they robbed the bank. Get the rest of the boys, quick. Get them.
While the citizens of Wellston were kept at bay by the robbers within the enclosure formed by the fence, the robbers worked on the vault, and suddenly...
They got it. They blew the vault.
And here they come. Look out!
The robbers got away after a running gun battle, and with them went $5,000 from the vault of the Bank of Wellston. And this robbery remains the first and only case I can find of bank robbers actually building a fence around the bank and then proceeding calmly to rob the bank while some of them held off the townspeople by means of a barbed wire fence and bullets. Can you imagine that? Mr. James Artlip of Aurora, Illinois, likes the movies. Oh, you don't think that's new, huh? Well, Mr. Artlip is 68 years old. And on February 24th, 1939, he saw his first movie. When interviewed, said the newest fan of Hollywood's make-believe...
Yes, sir, I think they got something there. I sure do like them. Honestly, it's just marvelous. Pictures actually move on the screen, and you can hear the actors talk.
You like them, huh?
You bet I do. I think I'll go see another one sometime. Well,
why have you taken so long to get to a movie, Mr. Artlip?
Well, I just never got around to it before. I pass four theaters every day, but I just never thought about going into one.
Well, what made you go in this time?
Why, I saw it was a picture about Jesse James. Thought I might just as well see it, because I read a book about him.
So chalk up another conquest for Hollywood and the flickering photos, even though it did take them 68 years to win Mr. James Arfliff. Can you imagine that? Do you remember this startling statement at the beginning of the program?
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Well, like our others, that statement is true. Why? Because there is no such recognized town or city of Hollywood, California. It wasn't until the year 1910 that the motion picture producers realized that their needs for strong lighting could be filled by the brilliant Southern California sunshine and came to that region to build their first studios. They settled in the portion of the city of Los Angeles which had been the town of Hollywood. But in that same year, 1910, previous to the arrival of these first movie magnates, the town of Hollywood had already been annexed to the city of Los Angeles. And so our statement is true.
Motion pictures have never been made in Hollywood, California.
Can you imagine that? Well, now let's do a little foraging into the field of melody sleuthing. First of all, I want you to listen to a semi-classic selection, which I'm sure you've heard before many, many times. The orchestra is going to play only a few measures, so listen carefully. And as you listen, try to recollect the name of the number itself and also the more modern popular number which this semi-classic selection most resembles. Are you ready? All right, listen. Now, what was the name of that selection?
Oh, I remember that, Lindsay. It's Cavatina by the famous German composer Joseph Joachim Raff.
That's right. Raff's Cavatina. Well, now, among all of you here assembled, did anyone recognize it as the possible foundation of one of our most popular hits of a few years ago?
I think I did, Lindsay.
All right, what is it?
My Baby's Arms.
And that is also correct. My Baby's Arms. Listen now, ladies and gentlemen, and see whether or not there is a distinct similarity between Raff's Cavatina and that smash hit from the Ziegfeld Follies of 1919, My Baby's Arms. There you have it once more, friends. One more session of Can You Imagine That? We all hope you'll be listening on the same station when next we're scheduled to meet. Until that time, this is Lindsay McCary turning you over to the very good care of your own station announcer and saying goodbye now.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio and hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.